Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal-treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's heavenly gigantic, or it's hugely heaven-sent. Don't touch your set. It isn't broken, isn't even bent. Those really are the angels and the giants on the screens, though New York and Atlanta cannot figure what it means. No matter who should win tonight and win again tomorrow, for fans of underdogs and wild cards, there will be no sorrow. That's because the Giants generally finish second and haven't won a World Series since 1954. The Angels, in existence only since 1961, generally finish somewhere well below second, and they'd never even won a pennant until this year. But one of those teams is going to step out of character over the next week or so. Here to help us figure out which team is Dave Newhouse, who covers the Giants and other matters for the Oakland Tribune. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Good morning, Bill.
The Giants have been okay as far as getting to the postseason. They haven't had much luck getting past the first round before. Are fans in San Francisco shocked?
Well, I think that they're stunned. All four teams that got to the league championship series were underdogs. The Giants weren't thought to be the team that was going to the World Series. They haven't won a World Series in San Francisco in 44 years of trying. So, yeah, I guess you would have to say they're shocked.
In 1962, the World Series featured the Giants and the Yankees, and the Cuban Missile Crisis overshadowed that. Then in 89, the Giants came back for the Bay Bridge World Series against Oakland, and there was an earthquake, which devastated the entire area. Are fans assuming that there'll be a disaster this weekend?
Well, they haven't said it openly, but there have been some strange omens before the series. Some of the people who have been trying to get tickets, Bill, have been offering more than money. They've been offering their personal charms, if you know what I mean. There's a sense that these tickets are still very, very hard to get. Will they lead to a World Series? I don't know, but there's a lot of charm going on.
The series is being played up in the media as, a contest between Northern and Southern California. Right after the Giants won the pennant, there were chants of beat L.A. Is beating a team from Southern California, even if it's not the hated Dodgers, really that big a deal to Giants fans?
It's probably a bigger deal to Giant fans than Southern California fans, Bill. It's more of a, what they say about La La Land. It's more plastic. It's more laid back. There's more passion for baseball up here. Fans normally don't leave in the seventh inning of a 1-1 game like they do at Dodger Stadium. As far as the Southern California rivalry, I don't know. It's probably more of a football thing when they have the Rams and the Raiders down there and the 49ers up here. I think what everybody is focused on up here is ending those 44 years of doom and seeing the Giants finally win a World Series in San Francisco.
What about folks in Oakland? They've seen their team bounced out of the first round of the playoffs 3 years in a row. Have they transferred their allegiance to the Giants just because, what the heck, they're right across the bay?
No.
Short
that
answer.
Never happens. It's about 8 miles as the crow flies from the Coliseum in Oakland to Pacific Bell Park or Candlestick Park, which is right down the road. But no, there's it's like two different worlds. I think it would be comparative to, would Mets fans, if they were out, root for the Yankees who are in. No, you just don't see that happening. San Francisco is looked upon in Oakland as that haughty older brother who looks down upon Oakland, which is more of a blue collar town, probably a friendlier town, I would have to say. So there's not that crossover allegiance. There never will be that.
Any worry out there that the same thing will happen with this series that happened with the Subway Series a couple of years back in New York, where the rest of the country just said, bah, we don't care. This is strictly a regional rivalry.
There wasn't a great love across the country when the Mets met the Yankees. It was thought that, gosh, a Yankee-Met World Series would be just this thing that would grip the country. Well, it did just the opposite. The television ratings weren't I think what will have to happen is some emerging star will have to take over the country's imagination. Maybe Francisco Rodriguez, the reliever for the Angels. I mean, he's like 20 years old, and his first four victories as a major league player have come in the playoffs. He's young, handsome kid. He's fascinating. Or it could be Bonds, who's escaped the, that doomsday albatross thing about not being a player who delivers in the playoffs. Well, he is delivering in this playoffs. So if Bonds has a mercurial type of performance in the World Series, that could help ratings. But it's going to take one player or one incident, like a fight or something like that, to really grip the public.
I know Barry Bonds cares very much whether the Giants win the World Series. He wants a ring toward the end of his career, obviously. But I wonder how much he cares whether the fans will love him.
He cares very much. I don't know if it's known to the rest of the country, Bill, but Barry is well thought of in the community around this area. When he's told me this, when he walks around or has dinner in restaurants, people say nice things to him. He never hears the negative things that people read in the media or hear on the air, you know, whatever, it's electronic or print. He has a good feeling here. When he came back here and had a chance to sign with the Giants, there were tears in his eyes. There's been tears in his eyes a number of times since. Willie Mays, his godfather, said the other day that he thinks Barry will cry a lot if the Giants do win the World Series, because that's basically the only thing that Barry Bonds has ever wanted. And he has said this repeatedly, is to be in a World Series and hopefully to win a World Series.
All right, we've come to the critical point of this conversation, Dave. You got to give me a prediction.
Well, my predictions are... I wouldn't be good in the stock market, but I will give you my prediction. I just think there's something about the Giants that says they're going to win, but I think it's going to be a nail biter, a tug of war, and I really do believe it's going to go seven games. The Angels are a very scrappy team. The Angels have got all components working. Everybody is hitting. They've got a number of varying big game heroes. They've got this spunky attitude. Their pitching is good. They're just like the Giants, but there's something about the Giants. They've waited longer than the Angels to get this far, and I think they're finally going to get their first World Series championship in San Francisco.
Dave Newhouse covers the Giants for the Oakland Tribune. Dave, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Last Saturday afternoon, to the delight of a damp but euphoric gathering in Foxborough, Massachusetts, the New England Revolution held the Columbus Crew to a 2-2 draw, thus outpointing the Crew 5-2 in the semifinal series and earning the opportunity to play in Major League Soccer's championship game tomorrow. 4 days later, after the Revolution had finished an indoor practice, Coach Steve Nichol, named the MLS Coach of the Year on Wednesday, reflected on the final minutes of the draw, which his team had led 2-0, and acknowledged that he'd been worried.
I'd be lying if I didn't say I was concerned. I felt as though if we got to the 90 minutes without losing another goal, then we would be okay. I felt it was just a case of, you know, getting everybody together and shaking the cobwebs out and getting ourselves back to normal. Concerned, yes, but once we got to the 90, I was pretty confident we'd hold out and get to the final.
A large part of the reason Nichol could be confident is the defense that he's built for the Revolution since becoming interim head coach 8 games into the 2002 season. That defense begins with Aiden Brown, the goalkeeper. Playing every minute of every playoff game this fall, Brown has accumulated 4 shutouts in 6 games. A performance all the more remarkable since nobody wanted him when he became available in the dispersal draft last year. He went to Norway to look for work and only caught on with the Revolution after that opportunity didn't work out. This season, once Brown took over for the injured Jürgen Sommer, he grew into the job spectacularly, though the keeper gives a lot of the credit to his mates, particularly 33-year-old defender and national team veteran Carlos Llamosa.
Having Llamosa back there, a seasoned veteran like him, is so nice just because, you know, I look up and the guy, the midfielder, puts his head down. And, you know, Carlos is already moving to the spot where he's about to play the ball. And it helps us out so much just because he reads the game so well and he's such a quick guy for, you know, being an old guy, you know. So, I mean, it's everybody in the back has just done an amazing job.
In Sunday's championship game, the effective defense the Revolution have developed will face one of the league's most diverse and effective offenses. Galaxy striker Carlos Ruiz has 7 playoff goals in 5 games, and during the regular season, Los Angeles scored from all over the field. On the other hand, the Galaxy has appeared in 4 previous MLS finals, coming up short each time. This, according to L.A. defender Ezra Hendrickson, is not a concern.
Well, one thing I try to tell the guys, being one of the, you know, senior players on the team, is that, you know, we can't change what happened in 99, and we can't change what happened in 201 last year with San Jose. But what we can do is go there and make a difference this year and not let that stuff happen to us. I mean, we know that what we do Sunday could make people forget all those other finals.
Hendrickson also knows that to accomplish that, the Galaxy will have to not only confuse New England's defense, but foil the Revolution's offense.
Well, you look at a guy like Steve Ralston, and he makes a lot of things happen for him on the wing. And, you know, you have Taylor Twellman, and he's so good in the box, and he's so good at connecting on crosses and being on the end of crosses that we really got to have to keep an eye on the cross and, being aware of where he's at in the box because he's so, you know, slippery. You know, we have Fish over here that's slippery, but he's just as slippery as the fish, you know.
Tomorrow, the Revolution will try to be as stingy on defense and as slippery on offense as Ezra Hendrickson thinks they can be. Ticket sales this week indicate that the MLS final will draw a crowd of over 45,000 people, a number encouraging enough for Revs coach Steve Nichol to upgrade the ambience of the event.
Well, the atmosphere is no different to anywhere else in the world. You know, it's the biggest game of the season in the country, and obviously there's a lot of tension. And obviously everybody's looking forward to it.
Game time for the MLS Championship is 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow.
Olé, 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 olé. Olé, olé, olé.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The soccer team playing at Potbrook in the Netherlands has experienced a distinct home field disadvantage this season. In fact, the lads haven't played a single game on their own pitch because wild pigs have been tearing up the field, apparently to get at the savory worms living beneath it. Animal lovers have dissuaded local officials from shooting the pigs, but all may not be lost. Villagers have come forward with a plan that involves covering the field with human hair, a method of wild pig control which has been used for many years by farmers in the Netherlands and elsewhere. Pigs have a well-developed sense of smell, explained one advocate of the plan. As soon as they catch a human smell, they run away, never to return again.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The Vatican is revising the U.S. bishop's policy on sexual abuse of children by priests. You can hear the story at WBUR.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Toyota, featuring the Toyota Prius, the Sierra Club's award-winning hybrid-powered four-door sedan, featured during WBUR's Prius Pledge Drive, available at a New England Toyota dealer. The Music Emporium of Lexington, supplying acoustic guitars, banjos, and mandolins to discerning musicians of all levels. The Music Emporium, fine fretted instruments for the music enthusiast. And the Nature Conservancy, working with communities, businesses, and residents to save the last great places for future generations in Massachusetts. Information available at nature.org. The weather forecast, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain from late morning into the afternoon today, becoming windy later today, possibly near 60. Mostly cloudy tonight and mostly sunny tomorrow, highs near 60. It's 45 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, what has 106 legs, black and orange stripes, and no wins on the season? The answer coming up shortly. But first, De La Salle High School in Concord, California has won more football games in a row than any team in high school history. The Spartan streak spans 11 seasons. They lost their last game when Bush the Elder held the presidency. The team's success has brought national acclaim to this Roman Catholic all-boys school just east of San Francisco Bay. Last weekend, the Spartans faced Long Beach Polytechnic, ranked number 2 in the country by USA Today, just behind De La Salle. The Jackrabbits hope to end the Spartans' run at 129 straight wins. Ben Trefney was there, and he has our report.
Hit that. Come again.
On a clear day in early October, a dozen teenagers dressed in green and white uniforms run practice drills at De La Salle High School. The Spartans are tight today. They drop passes and fumble frequently as they learn new plays.
Looking at this guy, we got one read. Get on him, break down, and pitch the ball.
The team is preparing for a game they've looked forward to all year long. On Saturday, they'll play Long Beach Polytechnic, which has launched the careers of 39 National Football League players. But De La Salle has beaten them before. In fact, for more than a decade, Spartans have beaten every team they've played. The previous high school record for consecutive wins stood at 73. De La Salle passed that 5 years ago. Before practice, head coach Bob Latticeur and some members of De La Salle's eight-man coaching staff watch game film of Poly in the coach's office. They regularly arrive at 7 in the morning to work on strength and fitness with students, stay until 7 at night, and work most Saturdays. They also lead voluntary, summer-long conditioning programs in which every player takes part. Latticeur, who has coached the Spartans since 1979, says proper preparation has built the streak.
Our number one goal week to week is not to win. Our number one goal week to week is to fulfill our potential and try to create the best game we can create and to improve week to week. Usually the outcome of that is winning, and I'm not afraid or ashamed to say that winning is good.
The Spartans have been named high school champions 3 out of the last 4 years. They've been featured in the New York Times and on network television. Fox Sports billed last year's victory over second-ranked Long Beach Poly as the high school game of the millennium. That 29-15 win confirmed De La Salle's status as the nation's top team. It also put even more pressure on its players. Senior lineman Eric Sandy says his brother, a De La Salle football alum, needles him about keeping the streak going.
He calls me up and gives me a little chit-chat about game and what he thinks going to happen. He gets me a little excited. He says we have a lot of tradition going on and we can't lose it for him.
The anticipation can be nerve-wracking for parents as well, including Rick Cecil, father of first-year starting quarterback Britt Cecil.
Up to this point, I think he's handled it a whole lot better than I have, actually. A father's always going to worry about what kind of impact these things are going to have, especially if, God forbid, we were to lose the game.
Britt Cecil says he handles pregame stress by remembering that he's playing a game.
I'm still a kid. I'm just trying to have fun out here. That's basically all it is. I'm not trying to think about the pressure so much that I just, miss out on opportunities that I have. Maybe a year on down the road, a few years down the road, I can look back and say, I gave it everything I had, and it was a wonderful experience.
Game day finally arrives. De La Salle has rented the University of California's Memorial Stadium on the Berkeley campus because its home field holds only 8,000. Today, more than 15,000 fans are here to see what amounts to high school football's national championship. Scouts say Poly is faster and more talented. On average, each lineman outweighs his Spartan opponent by more than 40 pounds, and the Jackrabbits are amped up for the game.
We get the streak from now on.
While the fans cheer madly, the Spartans emerge from their locker room in silence. Quarterback Britt Cecil and running back Maurice Drew walk onto the field together holding hands as the rest follow in an orderly 2x2 line. De La Salle wins the toss and elects to receive. On their first drive, Drew and Cecil march the Spartans to the 1 yard line. Then,
Cecil on the keeper. Touchdown, Spartans!
Then late in the half, Cecil heaves it down the right sideline and hits junior receiver Cameron Colvin for a touchdown.
Guys, that's what's beating us. We're not thinking, not being smart.
Confusion ensues as soon as Long Beach Polytechnic takes possession in the second half. Their drive stalls at midfield, but a good punt pins De La Salle inside their own 1 yard line. Cecil converts a third and long pass to give the Spartans some breathing room. Then he hits wide-open senior receiver DeMonte Fitzgerald, who outruns the Jackrabbits for a 76-yard touchdown. The Spartans complete the drive with a two-point conversion, and the game is essentially over. Each team adds a late touchdown to make the final score 28-7. The Spartans' total yardage is 474, the Jackrabbits' 258. Quarterback Britt Cecil completes 12 of 17 for 237 yards and three touchdowns. After the game, a reporter asked Cecil how it feels to win.
It feels pretty good. I mean, it hasn't really hit me yet. I'm sure when I'm laying in bed tonight, it's going to hit me. I'll probably start crying or something. But that's the truth, too. It's overwhelming right now.
In the Memorial Stadium parking lot after the game, a few kids in Spartans jerseys toss a football around. They're De La Salle's junior varsity players, pretending they're defending the streak. Next year, they'll try it for real.
It's definitely a lot of pressure, but there's a certain honor to it in that you know that you're part of this long tradition.
Sophomore lineman Scott Hugo expects the next few years to wear him out.
Well, it's a part of the being the program is that it's the hard work that gets you into games like this with Long Beach Poly and gets you to the win. So, yeah, it's a grueling summer and everything, but it helps make you a better football player. And so if that's how it is, then I'm all for it.
That's how it is for the team that doesn't lose. And the streak lives on at 130 wins in a row. De La Salle plays Liberty High School today in Brentwood. For Only a Game, I'm Ben Trefney in Berkeley, California.
The National Football League's Cincinnati Bengals offer a bit of a contrast to the De La Salle Spartans. Over the past 10 years, the Bengals have posted a league-worst 301 winning percentage. Cincinnati is 0-6 going into their bye week. Though its star player Corey Dillon is under contract through 2005, earlier this week the running back threatened to retire at the end of the season if major changes aren't made. Joining me now on the line to tell the tale of the Toothless Tigers is Dustin Dow, who follows the Bengals for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Mr. Dow, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks. You know, I'd be interested to see who would win that Cincinnati-De La Salle game. That'd be a good one.
Well, you and I will get together after we go off the air. Maybe we can set up a promotion of some sort. 3 years ago, Corey Dillon threatened to retire and, quote, flip burgers after the Bengals went 4-12. He obviously did not retire at that point. Should we take his threat seriously this time around?
You know, I think this threat could be taken a little more seriously because I think 3 years ago, Corey thought the Bengals were ready to turn a corner. And clearly that hasn't happened at all. And he's embarrassed right now, along with a few of the other good players on the team who really are good players, but because they just have no leadership from management. It's just an embarrassing situation. And I would take him seriously. I don't think he would retire, but he would sit out. I mean, that's a definite possibility.
You speak about no leadership from management. The Bengals are the only winless team in the league. Ownership is still standing behind the head coach, Dick LeBeau, at least for now. The trade deadline has come and gone this week. What sort of major changes can the team make to turn the Bengals around this season and satisfy Corey Dillon and everybody else who cares about the team?
You know, I'll be honest, I don't see the Bengals making any major changes themselves. They brought in Joe Germain, a former Ohio State quarterback, to quarterback their practice squad and maybe instill a little bit of fire in the quarterback situation that they have going on there now, which we thought had been settled when they named John Kitna the starter for the rest of the season. Who knows now, and who knows about the two backups, Akili Smith and Gus Frerotte? It seems like the Bengals' permanent situations last 3 weeks, and that's it. Then they go on to something new. So, you know, who knows what the end of the season is going to look like? For the past 5 years, what the Bengals have done is they've got to a start like this, maybe win one or two games early, and then close out the season with a victory here, a victory there, and give a little bit of hope for next year for the unfortunate fans in Cincinnati who think year in, year out, that the Bengals are going to be better next year. And it's just not the case, not with Mike Brown in charge.
The Bengals are 10-28 since moving 2 years ago into the taxpayer-financed Paul Brown Stadium. This week it was announced that the Bengals' lease agreement will be reviewed by the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office because county commissioners apparently think that the team's poor performance violates the team's stadium deal. I have never heard of anything like that. Will we see the Bengals thrown out on their little striped ears?
Really, I don't think this is going to happen, but it's unprecedented. And it's an embarrassment to the city that this is even taking place. You know, 10-28 isn't that bad of a record over the period of the time that they've played in the stadium, but this 0-6 team is so non-competitive. I think this has to be a wake-up call to the ownership that, hey, this city is not going to stand behind just any team. We don't know if the county has a leg to stand on. We don't know if they really could sue the Bengals and win. But
this is an amazing thing. I mean, if this spreads, you know, various municipal bodies all over the country can sort of start sticking their fingers into the faces of general managers and owners of teams and saying, you better get out of last place or you're going to find yourself homeless.
Yeah. I mean, this would put incredible pressure on teams to win. But, you know, it's not just the losing. It's not just the fact that they're 0-6, because there have been other 0-6 teams. The Bengals themselves have been 0-6 before and not looked this bad. This is the worst I've ever seen them, ever. And team morale is at all-time low. I'm working on a story right now, in fact, about what players do when they're not playing football in the public eye. There are several of them who are embarrassed to say they play for the Bengals. They will not say they play for the Bengals when they go out. Because they are embarrassed.
They go out for dinner, and the waiter says, hey, you're a big guy. What do you do for a living? And it's, oh, I'm a house painter.
Yeah. And there was one player in particular who said a guy recognized him from being at Paul Brown Stadium, and he didn't say that he played football. He just said, oh, yeah, I just go down there on business.
You've mentioned that Cincinnati has a bye this weekend. Every team gets one over the course of the season, so they don't play. Is that a good thing for the team to have some time off, or is it detrimental for these players to be stewing over their poor record for 2 weeks instead of just one?
Well, they don't lose. They don't lose with a bye week. It almost feels like a win around here.
Yeah, their record does not get any worse this week.
No, it doesn't. A lot of the players are relieved. They really are. This wasn't your typical team where you lose and you want to get back the next week and prove that you can win. This is a team that just has no answers, and they know they have no answers. But like I said, it feels like a win around here.
Have you got a favorite Bengals joke, a kind of a one-liner or something that's making the rounds there?
Well, there's one that always seems to come up, and it's, you know, Dayton's about 45 minutes away from here, and the joke is always, why doesn't Dayton have a professional football team? And the answer is, of course, because then Cincinnati would want one.
Dustin Dow covers the Bengals for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Mr. Dow, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. When the World Series gets underway in Anaheim tonight, Faith Henderson of Fullerton, California, will be among the most enthusiastic Angels fans. She's also among the most loyal supporters the team has ever had. She was introduced to the Angels in the first year of their existence, 1961, by her husband.
Yes, he was a sports fan and got me started listening to them. I had to listen to them, or I would have been a sports widow, because he listened to all the sports.
Mrs. Henderson and I spoke on the phone earlier this week. I was curious to know how she felt that her favorite team, which had never been to the big show before, would be playing in the World Series itself.
Well, it's just a big thrill. That's the only way I can describe it.
I wondered also whether at some point between 1961 and this October, Faith Henderson might have considered shifting her loyalties from the Angels to a more successful ball club, say the Dodgers, a team almost in the neighborhood and one that's been to the World Series lots of times.
No, we followed them. We were loyal right from the start.
Do you remember the first time you saw the Angels play?
No, too long ago.
Yeah.
Don't ask me. I don't. Do you know how old I am?
I've been told that you're 102.
Right. Well, how do you expect me to remember details like that?
Pretty feisty fan, huh? And one who brings a serious level of concentration to the games she attends. Faith Henderson has no use for the silly, noisy thundersticks that lots of other Angels fans have been banging together this season.
No, I didn't use the thundersticks because I was too busy when I was there keeping score. The girl who drove me over to the game, she did all the noise and all the thundersticks and everything.
Faith Henderson, scorecard in hand, will be tuned in tonight when her Angels host the San Francisco Giants in Game 1 of the World Series.
Why you so be disgusted? Try to be amused, but since the winds have got rusted, you know the Angels want to wear my red shoes. But when they told me about the side of the bargain, that's when I knew that I could not refuse. And I won't get any older now. The Angels want to wear my red shoes. Oh, I won't get any older now. The Angels want to wear my red shoes.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Toyota, featuring the Toyota Prius, the Sierra Club's award-winning hybrid-powered four-door sedan. Featured during WBUR's Prius Pledge Drive, available at a New England Toyota dealer. Dixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses, with offices in the East and in California, and on the web at DixonPeabody.com. Good morning, I'm Bob See, and in sports headlines, Red Sox tickets will cost more next season. The overall price increase is 7%, but the upper bleacher seats will actually be cheaper, while the more expensive seats will cost more. The largest rowing event in the world takes place in Boston today. Almost 7,000 rowers expected to take part in the head of the Charles Regatta. Bad news for the Bruins. Goaltender John Graham and right wing Martin LaPointe are out of the lineup indefinitely due to injuries. And the New England Revolution faces the Los Angeles Galaxy for the MLS Cup tomorrow. This spring, join Jackie Lydon on the next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam and Cambodia. To learn more about this trip, call 1-800-909-9287. The weather forecast, mostly cloudy, with a chance of rain from late morning into the afternoon today, becoming windy later with highs near 60. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain early in the evening. It'll be breezy with lows in the upper 40s. And mostly sunny on Sunday with highs near 60. Clear Sunday night and partly sunny on Monday. In Boston, it's 45 degrees at 7:39. This is WBUR.
This is Dolores Handy. Monday on Morning Edition, we'll hear how efforts to improve security at the nation's ports are being hampered by carriers. We'll also have a report on how doctors are being re-educated on the drugs they prescribe and how they prescribe them. That's Monday on Morning Edition, starting at 5 on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a reunion of former pro ball players. But first, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Mr. Baseball is not one of the many appellations which could be applied to you. But since the World Series begins tonight in Anaheim, I should ask, are you a Giants guy or a Halo supporter?
I think this is going to be a great World Series. That's my prediction. I think it's going to be one of those seven-game deals that we talk about for years and years and years because they do seem evenly matched in so many different areas. I think the Giants have just enough firepower to win, so I think the Giants are going to win in seven games.
The whole world apparently wants former Seattle Mariners manager Lou Piniella. Is there any truth to the rumor that both the Angels and the Giants have already contacted him about managing tonight?
No, I think Dusty Baker and Mike Socha are probably the only two managers who are safe at this point. You know, there's never anybody more popular than a baseball manager you haven't hired yet. And Lou Piniella is a good one, and he has apparently reached his limit for whatever reason in Seattle. I don't have the faintest idea where he's going to wind up. I really don't. I mean, I think that the idea that you know, he might go to Oakland if Art Howe went to the Mets, of course, blew up at the end of the week. I can't imagine somebody of his temperament, and he's a wonderful guy, but he is a ferocious competitor and a real hothead. I cannot imagine him presiding over the landfill that are the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I don't care if they play in his backyard. That can't matter that much.
It's very strange that we have all this speculation this time of year about who will be managing whom next year. It seems to me Major League Baseball should do something to make sure, given the sagging ratings of the World Series, that the series is front and center, not speculation about managers.
Well, I think, you know, the one thing that baseball aficionados, of whom I am not one, as you know, will tell you that the great thing about baseball is to talk about baseball in many different areas at the same time. You know, Dan Okun wrote a terrific book called Nine Innings, which is basically looking at baseball through the structure of a nine-inning game. And the brilliance of the book was that's exactly what everybody does at the ballpark. Mm-hmm. They go to the ballpark, and the one thing they never talk about is the game on the field. They talk about whether or not they should trade the right fielder or what happened here 20 years ago. So if people are talking about baseball in the context of managerial switches while the World Series is going on, that's good, not bad.
Staying with baseball for a moment, Charlie, look out, Yankees, Dodgers, Red Sox, and Braves. The Florida Marlins say that they have money and they're willing to spend it next season. So I guess all the major league teams should be worried.
Well, Jeffrey Loria, who owns the Florida Marlins, is a chop shop operator. And he's, you know, they're all still entangled in that incredibly messy lawsuit that was filed, no coincidence, in Florida by the minority partners of the Montreal Expos, whence Jeffrey Loria came to Florida, where he was given another baseball team to run into the ground. I think Jeffrey Loria has to at least keep up the pretense of being in this to give the fans whose money he is sucking out by the boatload a winning team. So I think what you're seeing here is Jeffrey Loria demanding to be patted on the back for doing something that every owner ought to do anyway.
Charlie, this week, Tiger Woods joined the growing list of people speaking up about Augusta National, the golf course, and its membership policies, if you can really call this speaking up. Tiger said that the head of the National Council of Women's Organizations is right, and so is the Augusta chairman, so I don't exactly understand what this changes.
Boy, he really picked up and threw the pamphlet at Augusta National, too. Hootie is right and Martha is right. That's the problem, says Tiger. Boy, I'll tell you what. Why he's not in international diplomacy, it's hard to believe.
Doesn't pay enough.
My favorite Tiger Woods comment in the whole thing was, there's no substitute for looking someone in the eye, says Tiger, the most insulated athlete possibly in the last 30 years. But the relentless Martha Burke comes back with, I'd like to know what about sex discrimination he thinks is right. I can speak from personal experience, Bill. You don't want to know what Tiger Woods thinks about sex discrimination is right. It does nothing but get you in trouble.
Charlie, on Wednesday, a jury awarded $4.6 million to former NBA agent Eric Fleischer, who had sued his former partner Andy Miller, claiming that Miller had ruined his business. Wait a minute. An NBA agent stealing another agent's client? This seems impossible.
These cases almost never get to trial, and they almost never get to a verdict. This is a very, very interesting story, particularly when you realize that Andy Miller, who will be forking over the $4.6 million, to Eric Fleischer, was hired by Eric Fleischer's management company as an unpaid intern in 1992 and eventually became president of the company. Now that's the fast track.
Oh boy, I'll say. All you kids in college looking for work, internships, that's the key.
Internships and watch your boss's back because there's always some place to put the knife.
NBA Commissioner David Stern on Tuesday told Bloomberg News that he is in favor of college athletes receiving a stipend in addition to their scholarships. I wonder how the NCAA, not to mention the NFL, the NHL, organizations like that feel about this development.
Well, you know, the NBA is in a spot. They do not want high schoolers pouring into the NBA, even though most of the high schoolers who have done so have worked out pretty well, witness Kobe Bryant, Tracy McGrady, Al Harrington, Jonathan Bender, blah, 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 blah. But they don't want a general exodus. There's no legal way to stop one. And David Stern, alone, I think, among the people who look at college basketball, says one of the reasons that we are getting high school players in is because the logic of a four-year or three-year or two-year unpaid apprenticeship in the service of some coach who's making $3 million a year no longer makes either financial nor moral sense. What you have to remember about stipends is, and stipends have become quite the popular middle ground on this debate over the last few years. Mike Krzyzewski at Duke has come out in favor of stipends in the past. Once you pay a player a stipend, the war is over. That is pay for play. You cannot make a moral argument that it is moral to pay a player $350 a month, but it's immoral to pay him $1,000 a month. Once you're doing stipends, you're doing pay for play, no matter how you gussy it up.
It sounds to me as if you're saying that Stern's argument is motivated by trying to keep the high schoolers out of the NBA for a little longer rather than by a recognition, these guys are pros, let's pay them.
Hey, well, I think David Stern can't come out and say that, okay? But if somebody landed from Mars and looked at the Final Four, they would tell you it's a professional event.
Of course.
It has all the aspects except the players don't get a regular paycheck.
Terrell Owens was the story of the Monday night football game between San Francisco and Seattle, Charlie. He had two touchdowns, and after the second one, he outraged and angered many purists by pulling a marker out of his sock, signing the football, and handing it to his financial advisor who was seated in the end zone. Are you among those who feel that Mr. Owens has committed a heinous act of disrespect against the, in fact, de facto national pastime?
I haven't laughed harder watching a televised sporting event, I don't think, in my life. And you know what? I don't care about the dignity of the National Football League. I don't care about the thousands of players who have gone before. And I do not care that Mike Holmgren considers the whole thing shameful and a dishonor to anyone who's ever played this game. I watch sports on television to be entertained, and this was, by God, entertaining. Now, it's not going to be funny the next 15 times it happens. This is a classic example, by the way, of the media not creating an event but creating the controversy. Anybody who doesn't think this was fun to watch is either a football coach or wants to be.
Finally, Charlie, on Sunday, Chicago Bears running back Anthony Thomas, also known as the A-Train, rescued a man from a burning car. Good on him, I say. Can a Fox sitcom be far behind?
Absolutely not. And if I might just say about Anthony Thomas, da 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 da. Unfortunately, the driver, a gentleman identified as Mark Moore by the Chicago Sun-Times, was arrested and charged with DUI after Anthony had saved him.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and shares his incendiary wit each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
I kicked the ball.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Sixty years ago, the future of Major League Baseball seemed uncertain, though it may be easy for those who witnessed this season's labor strife to imagine the loss of baseball. The problem in 1942 had to do with the lack of manpower as a result of the World War II draft. One response was to create a professional baseball league for women. Marianne Holland of member station WVPE in Elkhart, Indiana, recently attended a reunion of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in South Bend, Indiana. She has this report.
And the first batter for South Bend, shortstop, a swell little rookie. This gal, I think
my friends and I went to the ball game, and they announced that anyone interested could try out right there before the game. So a few of us went down on the field, and the manager at touring teams asked if anyone pitched, and I did because I always played with my brother's teams. We didn't have girls playing baseball.
Gloria Cordes Elliott, known as Cordy during her playing days for the Kalamazoo Lassies, was one of the top overhand pitchers in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League from 1950 to 1954. She and other veterans have gathered every year since 1982 to remember the years they played ball.
I says, wow, this is really great. 18 years old, I was never away from home. So when it came to go to the tryout, packed up my stuff, and my mother took me to Grand Central Station, put me on a train, and the next thing I got off in South Bend, and I met somebody there, and that was it. From then on, I was in the league.
Many minor leagues disbanded during World War II, as an increasing number of young men of ball-playing age were drafted. Owners like Philip K. Wrigley of the Chicago Cubs feared the major leagues were also in danger. So in the spring of 1943, the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was formed. The South Bend Blue Sox and the Rockford Peaches were the only two teams with the league for all of its 13-year run. Lou Arnold played for the Sox from 1948 to 1952. She says at first, people came to watch the women as a novelty, but soon they would see more than just women playing ball in skirts.
I noticed when I was playing ball, there was a lot of fans that came, and they thought, oh, playing in a skirt, this is going to be something else. You know, what kind of a team is it going to be? Well, that lasted about one night. They came back. They didn't even know what we were wearing, some of them, because they couldn't believe the ability that the gals had.
The league ended in 1954, and it became a historical afterthought. But the 1992 movie A League of Their Own reestablished the AAGPBL in baseball history. Sue Kidd, a pitcher for the South Bend Blue Sox from 1950 to 1954, says until the movie's release 10 years ago, she didn't tell people about her professional baseball career.
A lot of people even that I talked with and worked with didn't know I played baseball because it's just something you didn't brag about. It didn't happen. You didn't know whether they'd believe you or not. They'd probably think you played softball.
But it wasn't softball. In women's baseball, runners took leads and stole bases. Pitchers threw overhand. There were real differences, though, in how women ballplayers were presented to the public. Until 1948, they attended charm school. They were expected to look like the girl next door in cleats. They were advised on beauty routines, clothing, how to wear their hair, and what social functions to attend. They were even issued an official All-American Girls Baseball League beauty kit. The charm school had ended by the time Kidd joined the league, but she says appearance was still emphasized.
When I tried out in Little Rock, of course, playing baseball, swimming, riding horseback all summer long, my hair was, I guess, kind of like if your mother put a dish on it and cut it off, because the things I did, she couldn't keep it curled. So one of the first things that they did, they nicely took me to a beauty shop, had my hair curled, got me some kind of different clothes. It was more stylish.
Gloria Cordes Elliott says the pressure to play well and look good was a challenge.
That was stressed. They wanted you to look like a woman and play like a man, and that's just what we did.
After 1948, attendance at women's games began to decline. In 1951, the league president resigned, and with no centralized control, the league began to break down. The 1954 season ended with only five teams remaining, down from 10 teams in 1948. Kidd remembers the day she found out the league was through.
Saddest day in my life at that time, really. Of course, you had rumors that it was going downhill, and you knew it was. But still, you just kept hoping that something would turn the attendance and everything around, and it would continue to be. Just a very sad time.
Elliott says she doesn't think her time in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League is the last time women will play professional baseball. She says she encourages young female athletes and tells them to get ready.
If it's your time and a league does form for women by the time you're old enough, hone up your skills now, enjoy it, and you never can tell what might come in the future.
These women say they're grateful they were a part of American baseball history, even if for a short time. They say they'll get together whenever they can to reminisce about the days when women played pro baseball.
Hey, let's hear the song. Let's go, gang.
For Only a Game, I'm Marianne Holland in South Bend, Indiana.
Stands, her head so proudly high, her motto do or die. She's not the one to use or need an alibi. Chaperones are not too soft, they're not too tough. Our managers are on the ball. We've got a president who really knows his stuff. We're all for one, we're one for all, we're all Americans. Yay!
Get him. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out California baseball mascots like the Angels' Rally Monkey and San Francisco's Crazy Crab, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from 102-year-old Angels fan Faith Henderson, who says she likes my delivery.
You speak very distinctly. I appreciate that.
One hopes Mrs. Henderson will find something to like in Jared Washburn's delivery tonight. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this is WBU.
Public Radio.
And this is WBU.